Well, good evening, and thanks for making it through the snow, and thanks for all the kind words and the careful support, and just a delight to be with you. I should say my wife did come along, Diane, but it was gracious of him to invite her, of the church to invite her, but she's a Minnesota girl, and so when she gets this close, she likes to go spend a little time with her sister, who lives in Fairmont, so she's down there for a couple of days. Today is her sister's birthday, so they're celebrating it together. I was in with this group we were just with Tim and Scott, and it was a church in Lancaster, California, and I was sitting just at dinner one night talking with one of the couples, never met him before, and I happened to mention Minnesota. I don't remember what context. They said, "Oh, you're from Minnesota? We're from Minnesota." I said, "No kidding. Where?" And he said, "Well, a little town near Mankato. I've probably never heard of it." I said, "Well, what town?" He said, "New Ulm. You ever hear of New Ulm?" Well, it turns out they graduated with my wife from New Ulm High School, and so I sat there and called her on the phone, and they had a little reunion across the continents, but it is a delight for her to have that opportunity, and really means her sister just fought her way by God's grace through some fairly serious cancer, and so it's nice to be able to be together. Now, just a quick word, and I with regard to Israel. Let me tell you something. I love taking groups to Israel because I think it may be the world's best teaching opportunity. God has left us this big blackboard you can walk around on. And you want to think through those biblical stories and so on. It's just a remarkable opportunity. I don't think I said this here. If I did, forgive me, but I realize that not everybody can do that, and so you always feel a little bit bad, but I think it's nice if the church is able to at least make it available, and I just want to say that, did I tell you the story that this last trip, when they showed up, maybe Tim mentioned it, that one of the guys was hauling his oxygen behind him, which is not a good sign for a trip that I take. It is important that you be able to walk, that you be able to walk 2 or 3 miles a day up and down hills and steps and over sometimes rough terrain. If you're thinking about it, it wouldn't hurt to do a little warming up, you know, get yourself used to that. Because we do. We have to go hard. And I'm not warmly affected by pilgrimages, where you go and you just stand in a big church and remember an event which perhaps happened there. There's something to be said for identifying those sites and so on. But my perspective is that, as I said to you last night in another setting, so much of the Bible is history. And history is played out on a stage. And that stage is still there. And it's played out within a culture. And in many ways, that culture is still there. And so if you can familiarize yourself with that stage and with that culture, you're tremendously advantaged, I believe, in reading those stories and understanding those stories, which are, after all, revelatory. They deserve to be understood aright. And so with all that, I love to do it simply because, as I say, it's such a marvelous teaching opportunity. But it's fair to say it's not the standard Israel trip. We had a pastor with us on this trip who had gone, did I mention this? Where was I talking about this? 4 years earlier. And he said that on the trip he took earlier, and by the way, his guide on that trip was a friend of mine who should know better than this. But he said at least twice a day they stopped for an hour or so at a souvenir shop. And they would get off the bus and go in the shop and they'd lock the door behind them. And you just had to stay in there until, you know, the last person had bought whatever he was going to buy. And, of course, the problem is that both the guide and the bus driver makes a piece of that. And I keep saying, I don't mind that. When we go into certain shops, I know that our bus driver, who's a good friend of mine, is gonna get a percentage. He's gonna get about 5% of everything you spend. When you walk in, they offer you a little card, and they're very careful to give you one card and the other bus another card, and then you present that, you get a 5% discount, but that's how they identify which bus driver gets a piece of it. And I don't mind that as long as the bus driver doesn't try and yank me across town to get into a shop. And there are very, very few, I don't know that we ever stopped to shop, but there were some places we stopped where there was a shop. And if you want to spend some time in that, we got time, that's fine. But I said it just to make the point that these trips are crafted as genuine study trips, which means we spend a lot of time with maps and notes and a lot of lectures on the sites and even lectures in the evenings a lot of times where we feel like we have to preview for what's coming up and so on. We work very hard to try and help you sort things out because you're getting so much data in such a short time that sometimes it all caves in and it gets hard to sort it all out. So we do what we can to make that work. So just that word, we will meet this evening, but just to perhaps excite some interest. Well, listen, last night I was going through these notes, and I want to go back. Take your Bible, if you will, and remember, go to Luke chapter 1. Our focus here is sort of the background, the setting of Jesus' public ministry. And it's kind of a catch-all, but rather than going through Jesus' public ministry itself, we went through his Passion Week a couple of years ago together, but I want to sort of set the scene, and so we looked at one of the very, very important ways in which the scene was set, the world was made ready, was this galaxy of Old Testament predictive prophecies, which were so specific and which were fulfilled so exactly in Jesus in such a way as to render his incredible claims concerning himself compelling. Remember, we talked about that on Sunday. And then last night we spent time just sort of surveying some of the highlights of this very, very defining, very important and defining era known as the intertestamental period, those 400 years between Malachi and Matthew, and those 400 years of the times of the Gentiles. Now, the times of the Gentiles go on, and they will until Jesus comes. But again, as we said last night, God had promised way back in the book of Deuteronomy that if Israel continued in her sin, he would visit her with these curses, and the greatest curse would be a Gentile overlord, and that's exactly what God did, and now he spells it out in Daniel, as we saw, and then we trace some of it. But if you look, remember, those four kingdoms, remember, the first Gentile kingdom to rule Israel, of course, is Babylon, but they're done and gone by the time the Old Testament closes. They're already history. So when the Old Testament closes, Israel is a satrapy. The governor was the satrap and the province was the satrapy. But Israel is a province under what empire? Persia. And Persia, of course, is going to be displaced by Greece. Alexander specifically, and Alexander is this great disciple or apostle or missionary of Hellenism. He doesn't impose it with any real draconian efforts during his lifetime, but sometime after he dies and his kingdom is divided, there are some of his successors, most notably this madman, Antiochus Epiphanes. The Jewish people renamed him Antiochus Epimenes, which means the madman, and he was all of that. But at any rate, Antiochus imposed these horrible restrictions upon Israel. Do you know the story behind that, by the way? I was hurrying last night. I should tonight, too. But this is the line in the sand story. This is where Antiochus Epiphanes, the Syrian Greek, remember now the general given, who he wasn't really given it, he sees it, but the general who had control to the north in Syria was named Seleucus. It's a Greek. And his descendants are called the Seleucids. And one of them was this man, Antiochus. And he had designs on Egypt. And he marched down there because the Egyptian kings were not able to resist him, but the Egyptian kings had appealed to Rome. And so, which was a little third-rate king. Well, it was the Republic era. But the Romans dispatched their forces, and the Roman general, remember, it's kind of a dramatic story. said to, when Antiochus showed up, Antiochus Epiphanes from Syria came down and was going to make war on Egypt. And when he got there, the Romans were there. And the Roman general, I can't remember his name, said, are you ready to make war with Rome and Egypt? And Antiochus said, let me think about it. And the general drew a line in the sand and said, think quickly before you step out of that circle. And when he stepped out of the circle, he decided against it. And it was in the face of that humiliation, you see, he's in Egypt. In order to get back home, he has to go through Israel. And it's on his way home in a rage that he takes out his anger on Israel and enforces those. This is 168. This is what we talked about last night. And in response to that, you had this revolt by the Hasmonean Maccabean family that resulted in the period of, you know, here's an interesting thing, by the way. From about, I said this last night, but from about 143 to 63 BC. 63 is the date we assign to the Roman control. Control passes from Greece, that's been this Seleucid Ptolemaic struggle, but from Greece to Rome in 63 BC. But from 143 to 63 BC, Israel was remarkably independent. The Maccabees or Hasmoneans were ruling. They were minting their own coins. They had their own standing army. They were defending their own borders. They were making treaties with foreign nations. They were functionally independent. That make sense to you? Now, the reason that's a little important to me is because, have you ever encountered the notion that in, well, you have, whether you know it or not, the notion that either in 1948 or 1967, the times of the Gentiles came to an end? You read this in a lot of popular prophecy speakers, and they'll say the times of the Gentiles. They'll say, first of all, it was 1948. That was the basis of, you know where I'm going? The late great planet Earth. Remember that book by Hal Lindsey? It made such a stir. And he calculated that the times of the Gentiles came to an end in 1948 when Israel became a state. And then he went to that passage where Jesus says that when you see the fig tree blossom, that generation will not pass away. Remember this? This was the primary means by which so many date setting. I don't like date setting for Jesus coming. When you set a date, you're mortgaging your future. If the date comes and Jesus doesn't, you're in deep trouble. But Hal Lindsey, bless his heart, I don't know what got me off on this, but real quick, said 1948 was the end of the times of the Gentiles because Israel had become a state. And then he said, well, an average generation is 40 years. So 1948 plus 40 is 1988. But he believed in a 7-year tribulation, so 1981. Remember, 1981, Jesus was going to come in 1981. And there was a lot of commotion. Well, 1981 showed up and Jesus didn't. So then what a lot of people did is they said, well, in 1948, Israel became a state, but the old city of Jerusalem was still in the hands of the Jordanians. And in 1967, they captured Jerusalem. So then they redid their calculation. And now it's 1967 plus 40 years is 2007. That's where I'm sorry, 1967 plus 40 years and so on. And my point is, on the basis of, that's really not where I was taking you, on the basis of both the 1948, which was in Israel became a state, and 1967 in the Six-Day War when they captured Jerusalem, both of them been appealed to as the end of the times of the Gentiles, because Jesus says in Luke 21:24 that Jerusalem will be trodden underfoot of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So they say, well, Israel's no longer under the heel of Gentile dominion. I would submit she is. And that she is absolutely dependent primarily upon us. And here's where I'm taking you. What got Bookman there? I lost my own track for a minute. But here's where I'm taking you. This is not the first time when Israel has had that measure of independence. From 143 to 63 BC, Israel, and that's at the end of the Greek period and before the Roman. That makes sense to you. It's at the end of the third era, and then before Rome even took over, she had every bit as much independence in terms of her running her own affairs and so on. But she was only, the only reason at that time that she had that measure of independence was because the Syrians were so busy with the Parthians, they couldn't attend to the Israelites. That makes sense to you? So they were kind of took their eye off for a while, and she had. And by the same token, Israel does have, she does conduct her own to no greater degree than she did in that era. So I don't know, maybe I lost you entirely, but my point is that to finish the thought is that the third empire was Greece, and it culminated in this period from about 143. It was 143 BC. That the Syrians quit the territory. They gave up the fight. They abandoned their fortresses in Judea and they went back home. They walked away from it. And that's why from 143 BC to 63, when the Romans showed up under Pompey to settle an argument over who was going to be the high priest, it became functionally the authority there in Israel. From 143 to 63, they had some measure of independence. But here's the thing. During that time, this is where we left off a little bit last night. I just want to pick it up with Herod. During that time, the family of the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, the high priest, the priests, they weren't high priests. They seized the high priestly office, but they were not of the proper line. They were priests. They were Aaronic. But they seized control, and it was they who had to be dealt with by Herod. Now, if you look in Luke chapter 1, tonight we want to think about John the Baptist, but I'm going to spend a little time backgrounding it, finishing what we're doing last night. Because in Luke chapter 1 and verse 5, which begins the narrative, and I asked you last night, what was the first chronological event of the Old Testament, the New Testament era? And in fact, it was this event right here, which begins in verse 5, where Zacharias, the aged high priest, is in the holy place. We'll come back to it in a minute, but notice it says in verse 5, there was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias. So when John the Baptist is born, it is in the days of Herod. That's King Herod the Great. Now, if you go over to Luke chapter 3, you have the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry, some 30 years, a little more later. And it says in Luke chapter 3, it says, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, that would have been, by the way, somewhere around 29 A.D., Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee. Now that is Herod Antipas. That's the fox that we talked about in Luke 13 the other day. This is Herod the Great's son, okay? And his brother Philip, that's another brother. That's a half-brother and another son of Herod by another wife. By the way, time out real quickly. Do you remember that John the Baptist is going to die at the hands of Herod Antipas? That's the first Herod there in that verse. The Herod who was Tetrarch of Galilee is Herod Antipas. That's the man who is going to take his brother Philip's wife. Remember that? And John the Baptist confronts him over it, and ultimately the woman herself, Herodias, induces her daughter Salome to ask for the head of John the Baptist on a charger. So I'm just here to tell you this is not very important, and like I say, you'll be at the Bema Seat a long time before this particular little factoid comes up, but here it is. In verse, when it says Herod, alright, I'm back in chapter 3 verse 1, Herod being tetrarch, that's Herod Antipas. Then it says, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Aturia and Trachonitis. That's a different Philip. That's not the Philip. I just learned this a little while ago. That's why. There were two sons of Herod named Philip. He had a lot of wives. And one of them never left Rome. He lived his whole life out in Rome. That's the brother whose wife Herod Antipas stole. This is not the same Philip. Do you care? I always thought it was, and then I just came across it not too long ago. But at any rate, so when John is born, it's in the days of King Herod. When John begins his ministry some 30 years later or so, he does it when Herod Antipas is ruling in Galilee, and Pontius Pilate is ruling in Judea. Let me just background that just a little bit. And by the way, I drive people nuts with whatever book I just read. But I just finished a really remarkable book that anybody in the room would really enjoy. And it's called Pilate. It's a historical novel on the life of Pilate. And I learned a lot of Roman history, really fun Roman history, reading this book. It's by Paul Meyer, M-A-I-E-R. Anything you find by Paul Meyer is well worth reading. Tremendously solid historian and Bible-believing Christian. And he's written a lot of stuff in defense of the historicity of the Bible against the Arians and this ilk and so on. But Paul Meyer, but at any rate, this is what's at stake. When Rome was gaining hegemony over the Mediterranean world, which she did as often diplomatically and politically as she did militarily. There were plenty of military conquests, but a lot of these nations just kind of fell like plums, as did Israel. There was never a great battle. It's kind of like a ripe plum into Roman control. But after they had seized control, they had a great deal of time reigning in the they had a great deal of trouble reigning in the Hasmoneans, and there was a man, I mentioned him last night, his name was Antipater. Antipater is Herod's father. Antipater is an Idumean. Now what does that mean? You know, the New Testament word is Idumean. What does it mean? It's an Edomite, and an Edomite is, he's an Esauite. Now that's significant, that Herod is a descendant of Esau, the hated brother of Jacob / Israel, right? So now you have this Edomian, this Edomite chieftain, really. He was kind of a highway brigand, Antipater was, but he had come to the rescue of Julius Caesar at one time in Egypt, and he had made himself, he had developed close relations with Rome, and because Judea, not Judea, the whole area, all right, time out. I'm going to call it Israel, the land that we're talking about. The Romans called it what? You know, after the second century, the Romans called it Palestine. And Palestine, up until the 1970s, was a politically innocuous word. But once Yasser Arafat invented out of whole cloth the Palestine Liberation Front, and then invented the fiction that there was a Palestinian people, it's become a very, very incendiary term. So you have to watch the word Palestine. But in fact, do you know the word? I'm really jumping around here. Where it came from? It's actually a corruption, a Roman corruption, not deliberate. It's just their corruption of the word Philistia. And I'm jumping way ahead here, as long as I brought it up. But you know, most of you know, that there was a Jewish revolt after the days of Jesus that resulted in 70 AD in the destruction of the temple, right? That's called the Zealot Revolt. About 60 years later, there was a second revolt under a man named the Bar Kokhba, and the Roman emperor at that time was a man named Hadrian, and Hadrian put that revolt down, and it was ugly. Jewish people are remarkable fighters when they're in their own land. I mean, and the Romans always underestimated the difficulty they were going to have in putting down a rebellion. And that little Bar Kokhba revolt exploded, and it took two legions to put it down, and took them 3 years, and that was in 135. And Hadrian had it up to here with the Jewish people by then. And so he tried to wipe it clean and remove every remembrance of things, especially Jewish, but also Christian, and he renamed it. And he named it Palestine. And he named it Palestine with a deliberate intent of removing any memory of Israel. He was tired of them. He banned them from the land, and they came back soon enough. But My point is, that's where the name actually comes from. But all throughout, especially the 20th century, when the Jews started to go back in the 20th century to Israel and make Aliyah and settle in the land, they would say they were going back to Palestine. They formed an orchestra. It was called the Palestine Symphony. They started a newspaper. It was called the Palestine Post. Now, when they became a state, it became the Israeli Symphony, and then it became the Jerusalem Post. But the word Palestine was not a politically incendiary word at that time. Does that make sense to you? Like today it is. So if you look in most atlases and so on, it'll be referred to as Palestine. I understand. For my purpose, I'm going to call the land, the whole land, from Syria in the north to Egypt in the south, from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, I'm going to call it Israel, okay? Herod the Great, I'm sorry, back up one step. Antipater had been made by the Romans king in Israel. Now, let me introduce something to you. This is a little technical, but it really shows up. See, here's the thing. Have you ever noticed that at Jesus' birth, there's a king, his name is Herod, and yet when Jesus ministers, there's a prefect, his name is Pilate, and he's not a king. What happened? Well, very simply, as Rome established her vast ribbon of land around the Mediterranean world from India to Britain, that empire that she established, there were many of the areas she controlled she made into provinces. And the distinction of a province was that they dispatched somebody from Rome to control that. That make sense to you? But other parts of their empire they allowed to remain as client states. So they could have their own kings, and the kings could succeed one another. Now every generation, if a king died, and in his will, for instance, when Herod died, he divided his kingdom among three of his sons. Those sons had to go back to Rome and appear before the emperor and be interviewed by the Senate and awarded their rule. And that decision was made. Remember when Jesus told a parable in Luke 19? He said there was a man who went away to receive a kingdom. That sounds a little foreign to our ears, but that's exactly the way it was in the first century. Rome was running things, but she did allow certain areas to remain client states. Now, if it was a client state, they could have kings, and furthermore, they minted their own coins, they collected their own taxes, they had a huge tribute that they had to pay to Rome every year, but they administered their own affairs, they could have standing armies, they could have, again, they could have diplomatic relationships with others, they could form treaties as to who could travel through and so on, but if they were a province, all of that was done in Rome. Does that make sense to you? Herod Antipater is made king of the entire land. When he dies, he begs the Senate to make his son, Herod, king. They do make him king. So he is king over the entire land. Now, this is another subject, fascinating to me, but I'm a dweeb. And I'll talk to you a lot about this if we go to Israel together. Israel is important all throughout so much of ancient history for one reason, and that is that she is the one narrow spot on the international highway called the Fertile Crescent. We talked about this? I think I talked about it in school, actually. I'm not going to go into it, but you understand the significance of that? You have this hugely important international highway called the Fertile Crescent from Mesopotamia to Egypt, and all the traffic, because of the Arabian Desert here and the Caucasus Mountains here, and if you're going to go to Europe or if you're going to go to Egypt and Mesopotamia, you're going to follow this Fertile Crescent, and there's one narrow spot. It is the Jezreel Valley. Now, what does that mean? That means if you can control that area, you can monitor and tax the movement of all of those caravans. Herod was given that plum, and he made much use of it. Herod the Great now. He becomes king he's appointed king in 42. He takes possession in 40. It takes him several years to bring things under control. But Herod, and this is right at what we call, remember this from your high school history? The period called the Pax Romana, When Rome has arrested piracy, she has built this remarkable road system to move her armies. The sea lanes are opening up, and so their trade is just exploding. And a tremendous more, I've never seen percentages, but I'll guarantee you more than half of it had to go right through Israel. And Herod learned to tax that. And furthermore, the other thing that Herod did, don't get me started on Herod, but are you familiar with this? He built the first man-made harbor in human history. It's called Caesarea Maritima. He had two problems, maybe three. Number one, just in terms of military expediency, it was very, very important to have a harbor. See, Israel, I mentioned this in Israel when I'm there, but have you ever noticed that even though Israel has a long shoreline, she has never gone to sea? You ever notice that? Phoenicia, just directly north, they were always seagoing people. Israel never went to sea. I think that was very deliberate on God's part. I don't know what wasn't deliberate on God's part. But the fact is, the reason is because all of the prevailing currents travel from the south of Egypt, from Egypt all the way up along that Mediterranean shoreline. And so you get all those tons of silt that are being dumped into the ocean every year at the mouth of the Nile, all are swept up along that coast, and none of the mountains in Israel go down to the sea. So if you don't have mountains that actually project into the sea, you don't have these natural harbor breakwaters where a ship can get in, and if a storm comes along, they're going to be dashed if they don't have that breakwater. Does that make sense to you? And so because Israel never, Herod was given a land that didn't have a natural harbor. She had ports. She could have a dock and the ship could drop its anchor out there and dinghy stuff in and out and so on, but an actual harbor where ships would be safe from a storm. They never had that. And Herod wanted it. He wanted it because militarily it was expedient. Secondly, he desperately wanted to transform little tiny third world backwater Israel, this little tiny backwater Roman province, into a major Roman center of culture. And in order to do that, you had to have a harbor. And then the big issue is this, that you had all of this spice trade. Now, I'm doing this all without a map. You can see in the back of your Bible if you want. Shame on me. But if you can picture it, the spice trade is coming up from Saudi Arabia, coming up across the desert, coming right across Israel. The main route comes right through Israel, but there's no port. So they're either going to go up to Tyre or down to Alexandria. And he wanted to capture and tax. And it's not just tax. You're going to warehouse. You're going to have all the handling and so on. He wanted that business. And so Herod invented. Now, I don't know that Herod did much of this personally, but Herod was one of the greatest builders we've ever known, the world has ever known. He was an absolute genius, and he was audacious. He was remarkably audacious. He was never satisfied with the topography of the earth the way God made it. And there in Caesarea, he sent his researchers out, and he found a special plaster made with a volcanic ash instead of sand that set up underwater. And they developed a means of building these huge forms and pouring that in there and then dropping it down to the sea bottom and anchoring it to the sea bottom. And they built a man-made harbor that could hold about 300 ships at a time. It was a beautiful, beautiful harbor, and it lasted for over 150 years, and it was a huge earthquake that destroyed it. It'd probably be there in large part today. I mean, it was that solid if it weren't for a huge earthquake that destroyed it about 150 years after it was built. And so he built Caesarea Maritima, Herod did, and it's Caesarea on the Sea. He named it for Augustus Caesar, actually, the predecessor to Tiberius. And he built it. It's on the seacoast, and he built it like a huge saucer, because one of the problems you always had in the ancient world was the dung and so on. You'd have to keep the city clean, and he built it in these stages with underwater locks subterranean locks. And so when the tide would come, it would move, and then he had sluice gates at the top of the city, and it opened those sluice gates and flushed the whole city every night. And it's just an amazing piece of work. And that was just one of the things that, that Herod did. But I mention it just to make this point that Herod, well, let me tell you one other thing before I make my point. Herod desperately wanted to make his province, as I say, into a Roman center. Now, Caesarea Maritima was dominated by shrines to pagan gods. As you came into the harbor, there was a huge man-made podium, earth podium, and on the top of it was a temple to Zeus, and everything about the city of Caesarea was Roman and pagan and secular, huge bathhouses and so on. And all of that was a horrible offense to the Jewish people, to those who wanted to remain loyal to the law. And it was largely, historians will suggest, some will, that it was in response to that that the Jews were able to induce Herod to rebuild their temple. So to kind of buy off their anger over Caesarea, later on, he reconstructed the temple. Now, when you go to Israel, you spend any time at all, you've got to spend some time with this marvelous temple. The Jews have had two temples. Okay, little quiz. Who built the first temple? Solomon. It was a wonder. People came from across the world to see that temple. Remember that? And it was destroyed by, talked about this last night, Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar, 586. The second temple, tougher question, was built by whom? Zerubbabel. It was a horribly disappointing affair. It was a little tiny wooden temple on it. I say little tiny. It had to be the same, had to be the required dimensions, but as far as the courts and so on, it was just a little tiny temple built very exactly on the same spot that Solomon's temple had stood, but it was horribly disappointing in an unwalled city. As a matter of fact, you have that remarkable verse in Ezra chapter 3, because Ezra is describing the building of that second temple. And he says that when they laid the foundation for the second temple, on the one hand, there were young men who had lived most of their lives in Babylon and had never been able to offer any sacrifices. And so when they laid the foundation and offered sacrifices, remember, they wept with joy. Remember that? But the verse says, Ezra 3:3, that there were other men, white hairs, it says, who were old enough to remember Solomon's temple. And when they looked at that squatty little affair, they too wept, but they wept for sorrow. And Ezra says you couldn't tell who was weeping for joy and who was weeping for sorrow. Which is kind of the whole restoration period in a nutshell. But that little tiny squatty temple that was such a disappointment is going to be hugely, hugely remade by Herod the Great. And according to John 2, you remember, he spent 42 years building it. But he spent about 13 years actually building, never quite got done, because you know why? He had imposed a two-day temple tax on all the Jews of the world to pay for this, so you never finished that project. You know, I said the bridge with the toll. Remember they were going to take that toll station off as soon as they get done with the bridge. We'll take the toll station down. They never took that toll station down. The point is that he built that marvelous, and it is interesting. One of the prophets that God raised up to encourage the Jews in the days of Zerubbabel in rebuilding the temple, Zechariah, said, "The glory of this latter house will be greater than the glory of the former house." And in point of fact, Herod came along and made it into one of the most astounding buildings in the whole world. So, and I say that, and by the way, and it's fun to take the tour and see this, but there are engineering feats accomplished by Herod in building that second temple that we don't know that we could duplicate today. Isn't that true? I mean, we can stand next to a stone which was carved out of a quarry and moved to a place that weighs 570 tons. How long do you think it is? In here, yeah, it was about 40 feet. It's not quite as long as one of those walls, but it weighed 570 tons. And how Herod moved that stone, we have no idea. Whether or not we could do it, we have no idea. But I said that just to make the point that now, and watch this. If I've wandered, forgive me. But and there are all sorts of. Matter of fact, it's one of the things I always say is when you go to Israel, you spend as much time almost talking about Aaron as you do about Jesus, because he left his fingerprint all over the land in these monumental building projects. But Herod really crystallized this issue that we talked about last night. Because on the one hand, Herod, well, he ostensibly converted to Judaism, and every year at the feast seasons he would be the first one to offer the sacrifices and so on. But he was a functioning pagan, and he was a moral lecher, and he was an absolute butcher, and he was one of the most evil men who ever lived. And there were very, very few who hadn't felt the lash of Herod sooner or later. He was so, as a matter of fact, Josephus, the historian we talked about last night, has a long section in which he describes the death of Herod. It's about a paragraph, about a column and a half, and he describes what was wrong with him and what part of his body was diseased and how you couldn't stand to be in the room with him because of his breath, and how it goes on and on. And I always say there are no tear stains on that page, you know, from Josephus. He's enjoying this narrative, I'll guarantee you. But you know, Herod left an order. He knew that when he died, there was going to be dancing in the streets. And so he demanded, as he was about to die, he died in Jericho, he demanded that all the chief men of Jerusalem be rounded up and taken down to Caesarea and be held in the Colosseum there, and at his death they all be slaughtered, because that way there would be mourning in the streets of Jerusalem. Now, Herod's sister remanded that order. They were rounded up and they were kept there. But when Herod died, she remanded the order. It didn't happen. But I mean, it tells you something about who this man Herod was. But here's the thing. This is the really remarkable dynamic, I think, that colors this era so. On the one hand, Herod was a pagan. He, like I say, he was a man of, he's just the most wicked man. His slaughter of the innocent children there in Bethlehem is so typical of the man. On the other hand, life has never been so good in Israel. He has brought an era of prosperity, and there is work to be had, and people are coming from all over the Mediterranean world just to work, because there's so much work. In 62, the Roman officer, by that time he was called a procurator, in Judea, ceased work on the temple, and 18,000 people were laid off that quick. There were riots in the street because of the unemployment and so on. So Herod had, there's an interest, I better not get into that, but Herod had brought such vitality and pride. People were coming from across the world. So on the one hand, you're kind of strutting, you're thinking, boy, I'm a Judean, this is something, you know. Whereas it used to be the Judeans were just this backwater, insular, unimportant. So, on the one hand, do you remember there was a party in the New Testament called the Herodians? They were the ones who supported Herod. Jews who supported Herod. Why do you suppose they did? Because life was so good. And this we talked about it last night, this issue over whether or not you're going to abide by the law and pay the price and be distinct, or whether you're going to buy into the Greco-Roman culture and so on, and it really materializes, crystallizes under Herod. All right, I got to finish this thought, go on to the next thing, we'll be done. Herod dies probably around 4 BC. Now, there's some dispute, I don't want to get into it, but let's say for our purpose right now, he dies in 4 BC. Herod is alive when Jesus is born, right? The reason I say, and it may seem a little... It may seem a little strange that Jesus was dying, maybe I said this to you before, about 4 years before Christ, that Jesus was born about 4 BC. But it's just a matter of when the calendar, our calendar was put together, there was a mistake made. But when Herod dies, there's a huge struggle as to whether or not his sons are going to succeed him. He has put in his will that the kingdom would be divided among his three sons. And they have to go back to Rome and to see if the Romans will allow this. In the meanwhile, do you remember this? Mary and Joseph had fled to Egypt with Jesus. You remember it says that they came back intending, we'll talk about this tomorrow night, intending, I believe, to settle in Judea. But when they heard that Archelaus had indeed become king, do you see what's at stake there? There were several months that went by. And by the way, there were delegations of Judean leaders who went back to Rome and begged the authorities not to put the Herodian sons in power, begged for the Hasmoneans to be restored, or begged for them to become a province. Someone would rather be a province than to be under those Herodians. But the Senate finally found in favor of the Herodians, and so now Archelaus is given control there in Judea. That's when Joseph and Mary hear that Archelaus is in fact going to rule in Judea, that's when they move back up to Nazareth. Remember that? So at any rate, here's where I'm taking you. Herod dies, the kingdom is divided, do you care, but up to the north, Galilee is given to Herod Antipas, Galilee and Perea. Judea and Samaria is given to Archelaus. And then this area way to the north, what today is called the Golan Heights, what's called the Decapolis in the Old Testament, or in the New Testament, is given to Philip. Those are the three sons. Now, Archelaus is so crooked that he's deposed in 6 AD. When he's deposed, the Romans determine to make Judea and Samaria, not Galilee, Judea and Samaria a province. So now, rather than having a king there, they send representatives, they send officers. So by the time we get to the New Testament, I'm sorry, to the ministry of Jesus, in Judea and Samaria, the man ruling is not a king, he's a prefect. Time out. What makes a king a king? What's distinctive to a king? Well, I mean, what's the sine qua non, the without which not? Pardon me? It's heredity. When you die, your son succeeds you. That's what makes a king, distinct from all other. You can have all the world power in the world, not be a king, right? Moses was pretty powerful, check with his sister and brother, but he wasn't a king. When he died, nobody supposed that his son was going to succeed him. So Rome allowed these client states to have king. When you get to the New Testament, you keep running into these Herodian kings. That is, you got King Herod, then later on, Jesus makes his way over to Perea. We saw it in Luke 13 the other day. And they warn him, Herod the fox wants to kill you. Remember that? And then when Jesus is arrested, he's being tried by Pilate. Remember that? And when Jesus' accusers say, this man has made trouble ever since Galilee, Pilate says, wait a minute, I'm not in charge of Galilee. So he sends him over to King Herod. That's Herod Antipas. Remember that? Later on, this Herod Antipas is the one who kills John the Baptist. And then even after that, there is a son, a grandson of Herod. I think he's Antipas' son, but I'm not positive. But there's a grandson of Herod the Great named Agrippa. And Agrippa is the guy in Acts 12 who puts to death James, the brother of John. And when he sees that the Jews like it, he arrests Peter. Remember that? And Peter is delivered in the middle of the night. And then later, Agrippa goes to the theater in a beautiful costume, and the people welcome him as a god. And God sends. Remember, he gets a pain in his gut. He's eaten of worms. Remember that? That's Herod the Great's grandson. All right. I know I'm boring you to tears, but I got to tell you one other thing. Later on, when Paul is arrested, he's in Caesarea, and there is another king who is visiting there named Agrippa. That's Agrippa II. That's a great-grandson. There are four generations of Herods that you're going to encounter in the New Testament. Herod the Great is the guy who kills the babies but dies shortly after Jesus is born. Herod Antipas is the guy who is king during Jesus' ministry, but he's king in Galilee and Perea. He's not in Judea. He does try Jesus briefly. He thinks he might be John the Baptist come back from the dead. Remember that? That's Herod Antipas. Herod Agrippa is the guy who is ruling in Judea later on, and who actually was ruling more than that, and is eaten of worms in Acts 12. And then his son Agrippa II is the king who is almost persuaded when Paul speaks to him. Remember that in Acts 21? So you actually have four generations. And it's all a function of this attempt on the part of Rome to find somebody who can control these Jewish people. And Well, all right, with all that background, way too much. Let me take you to John the Baptist. We're going to be quick, but there are a couple things I just want to... And again, John the Baptist is born during the days of Herod. Now, let me tell you why I think there are any number of reasons why it's very, very worth our time to spend a little, to focus for a bit on John the Baptist. But one of the things, and I want you to think about this, I want to stir up your pure minds just a moment. I mentioned this to you in passing last night, but one of the issues which I'm absolutely astounded that so many scholars, really, and students of the New Testament study the life of Jesus, and they never seem to ask themselves this question: how did Jesus get away with this? I'm going to say it again. Rome has this vast empire, and all throughout her empire, she has people who don't want to pay taxes to Rome, who don't want to be ruled by the Roman people. And so they are constantly in fear of rebellion and sedition. And they have no patience whatever for pretender kings. Somebody in a local area goes around saying, "I am your king." They won't put up with that. Now, this, and it was right at this period that Rome had gone through, especially in Israel. All right, real quickly. When Herod died, 4 BC, huge rebellion. They have to put it down. When Archelaus is deposed in 6 AD, and Israel is made a province rather than a client state, huge rebellion. Rome has to come and put it down, has to bring troops from Syria and so on. So Rome was up to here. They knew that Israel was a place where seditionists tended to arise, and they were constantly on the lookout for it. And they had developed crucifixion, by the way, the primary reason that they had fine-tuned this gruesome means of execution called a crucifixion was to put down sedition. You'll often hear, by the way, that it was primarily a slave's, it was an execution for slaves, but it really wasn't. But one of the areas in which the Romans were most fearful of rebellion was among the slaves. There, you'll see various estimates, but somewhere up more than a quarter of the people in Rome were slaves. And so they were always fearful of a slave. But my point is, here you are at an era where Rome is so very nervous about sedition. And in the country where they have every reason, because of recent history, to be the more nervous about sedition. And yet Jesus goes about for 3.5 years claiming to be Messiah King, and he gets away with it. How did he get away with that? Now, I don't think there's one single answer. I think there are a number of answers, and it's fun to explore. I'd really like to see somebody really struggle with it. But I'm convinced, and this is what I'm going to try and make the case for tonight, that the primary answer to that is John the Baptist. I think John the Baptist was hugely strategic in the ministry of Jesus in many ways, but perhaps primarily in this, that John the Baptist created such a widespread following. And then, all right, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but think what happens. John the Baptist comes and ministers for several months. We don't know how long, but several months before Jesus commences his public ministry. The Bible is explicit that all Jerusalem and Judea came out to him. Tens of thousands of people came out and were baptized by John. And what were they told? There is one coming after me who is going to baptize you with the Holy Spirit. The Messiah is soon to come. Now, those people all went back to their villages to wait. One of the dynamics that shows up again and again explicitly in the narrative, again and again, you'll read that Jesus' enemies wanted to take him, but they could not because they feared the people. Jesus had this built-in constituency everywhere he would go, and it absolutely tied the hands of his enemies. That makes sense to you? I think John the Baptist, we don't credit him for this, but I think it follows. Now, let me just real quickly, in the Old Testament, and this is in your notes, I'll not spend any time with it, but in the Old Testament, there are three passages which anticipate a forerunner. When Messiah comes, he will be preceded by a forerunner. In Isaiah 40, it's the voice of one crying in the wilderness. In Malachi chapter 3, it's the messenger who comes before the messenger of the covenant. I will send my messenger before the messenger of the covenant who will come suddenly to his temple. And then in Malachi 4, 5, and 6, which, by the way, is the passage which is ringing in the ears of the Jewish people for 400 years. The last breath of Old Testament promise is, I'll send you Elijah before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord, and he will work revival. He'll turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers. Well, you'll remember that, as I say, heavens are as brass for 400 years, and then you have this remarkable event in Luke chapter 1. Let's look at it real quickly. Go to Luke chapter 1, and as you know, Zacharias, a godly high priest, not a high priest, a godly priest, just now, does everybody understand? Two things. Number one, God had established in the days of Moses as part of the law that there was a certain tribe, Levi, who would be functionaries in the temple system. They would oversee the entire Levitical, or the entire worship system. We call it the Levitical system because it was given over to the Levites, the tribe of Levi. Within the tribe, there was one family. It was the family of Aaron. And they alone could be priests. The Levites were workers in the temple, and they were musicians, or they would clean up, or they would carry the items and so on. But there was one family that were actually the priests, and they were the ones who actually manipulated the sacrifice. Well, those priests didn't live in Jerusalem. David, one of the things, remember David had wanted to build a temple, and God said, no, you're not going to do it. And so David had spent the last years of his life preparing. And one of the things he did was take all of those priests living in all of those cities, and he divided them up into 24 courses. And and they didn't necessarily, you didn't have one course living here. They lived all over the place. They could live where they want. They could move from Levitical city to Levitical city. Remember, God had identified these 48 cities where the Levites were all to live. But every 24th week, about twice a year, you'd leave your city and you'd come to Jerusalem because it was your course was due to function in the, and that's what's going on in Luke chapter 1, where it says in verse 5, there was in the days of Herod the king of Judea a certain priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah. Now there are those who believe, I know Arnie Fruchtenbaum does this, and I don't know for sure, but who believe that they can count back in the years of Jubilee and figure out when the Abijah would have been there, and on that basis date, have you ever seen this? Date the pregnancy of Elizabeth, and on that basis date the pregnancy of Mary. I don't know. I'm not at all convinced, but I don't know enough about it. But at any rate, what the Bible says is that it was this, there were 24 courses, and this one was called the division of Abijah, and it was their week to be there. And it goes on to say that his wife was also a Aaronic descendant. They were righteous. They were childless. And then it says in verse 8, so it was while he was serving as priest before God in the order of his division, according to the custom of the priesthood, his lot fell to burn incense. Now, I mentioned this the other day real quickly. Let me explain to you. Remember that the temple itself, now Herod had built this vast, vast temple complex, which was 35 acres large. You can put, you know, in the Temple Mount that Herod constructed, you can put over 250,000 people. I know that staggers the imagination, but you can't. I've seen pictures of over 250,000 Muslims praying on the Temple Mount all together at the same time at Ramadan. But at any rate, it was a huge area. But then you had the smaller court of the women and then the smaller court of Israel. And that was the actual Old Testament temple. That was the tabernacle system that had been set up. And that system, the temple itself, the inner temple, was composed of one court that had an altar and a laver. That is a place where things would be cleansed. And then beyond that, there was an actual building. And in that building, there was an outer chamber called the Holy Place, and it had three articles of furniture, the showbread, the lampstand, and then against the veil was the altar of incense. And then inside, the next chamber was called the Holy of Holies, and in the Old Testament, what was sitting in there, the only piece of furniture? That was the Ark of the Covenant, the most sacred piece of the furniture. Now, what's at stake is this, that every day there were two national sacrifices. They're called the morning and evening sacrifice. One was mid-morning, the other mid-afternoon. And here's the way the Jews live their day. They get up in the morning, the sun is hot, they go immediately to work. They don't begin their day with worship, and they don't begin their day with food. They might snack along the way, but they go right to work. In the middle of the day, the sun gets very hot. So when the sun gets high, around 10 o'clock or so, they'll break. And they'll come in and have a meal. That's their first meal of the daylight. And then they'll rest. until the sun gets past its apex. You start to get the afternoon breezes, then they'll go back to the fields, work until sundown, then they'll come in, have a meal, and go to bed. So that makes sense. That's the daily cycle. It's rather different from what ours is. Well, as they come in the middle of the day, that's when they have the morning sacrifice. And then just before they go back to work in the afternoon, the evening sacrifice. So you have these two sacrifices. And what would happen in both those sacrifices by Levitical law is that a whole bullock would be offered on the altar in the courtyard. But then a priest, and this was considered very special, so special that you could only do it once in your life. And so every morning, all those priests who in the course of their offering had never been privileged to do this would gather and draw lots. And the priest who drew the appropriate lot, are you familiar with drawing lots? Put stones in a bag and you pick them out and there's one stone that's a different color, and so that's the lot fell upon that person. Well, it was a very special thing. And what they would do is this. The lot, the priest chosen by lot would, as the animal was being sacrificed, he'd go and he'd scrape some of the coals into a pan and he would go into the holy place. And he would go to that altar of incense, which was a non-bloody altar. No sacrifice was ever made in there on the altar. All that was done there is those hot coals were placed on top, and then they would pour incense, perfume, on top of that, and it would produce this sweet-smelling savor, and that was a symbol of a prayer. And that's why these were the special times of prayer. Does that make sense to you? And so if you look in Luke chapter 1, it simply says in verse 8 that it was that while he was serving as priest in the order of his division, according to the custom of the priesthood, his lot fell to burn incense when he went into the temple of the Lord. Now, we're told here that Zacharias was an old man. So we can assume that every time he had come for all of those years, twice a year for a week, and he had maybe with some anticipation gathered with all the other priests. When you had done this, you were called a completed priest. This is Edersheim tells this story. He says that according to the rabbinical sources, when you had actually done this, you were a completed priest, you were never allowed to do it again. So here's Zacharias, he's an old man, and now the lot has fell upon him, and his first time and his only time in his whole life, he's able to actually go in. And do you understand the significance about it? Time out, I haven't got time for this. But interestingly enough, in Hebrews 9, where Hebrews is laying out the articles in the tabernacle, it says that there was the holy place with the lampstand and the showbread, and then it says this, then the Holy of Holies, which had the altar of incense. And people stumble over that in Hebrews 9, because, wait a minute, we think the altar of incense is out in the holy place, not the Holy of Holies. Why does it say? Well, the point is not that it was inside. The function of the altar of incense was to gain access to the Holy of Holies. In other words, it was part of the apparatus. Because on the Day of Atonement, when the high priest on that one day of the year would prepare himself and then actually enter the holy place, he would first of all burn incense. And some people think it was to deaden the glory of the glory cloud, so you could stand it. But at any rate, there had to be that incense, that cloud of that represent prayers, and then you would draw back the curtain and go in. So to approach the altar of incense was to, as intimately as could possibly be done in that dispensation, do business with King Yahweh, who lives in the Holy of Holies. That makes sense to you? Whose dwelling is in the Holy of Holies. So this is a huge thing, and Zacharias is in the midst of this, and you know that story. And look at verse 10, by the way. It says the whole multitude of the people was outside at the hour of incense. They were praying outside, because that's what was going on. Well, I'll leave it there. You know the story. As a matter of fact, it's I think what's going on in this. It says that, and as I understand it, the altar of incense would stand here, and you would, on the Day of Atonement, you would draw it back and step in to the high priest would, to the Holy of Holies. And now, he's burning incense, and all of a sudden, he sees an angel standing on that side of the altar of incense, as if he had just stepped out of the office. See what I'm saying? That's the point. He just came from the presence of God, as it were. And of course, Zacharias has for John, for the angel has for Gabriel, has for Zacharias this remarkable message that his wife, Zacharias' aged wife, is going to bear a child, and he's going to be the fulfillment of Isaiah 40 and Malachi 4. And Zacharias is perhaps understandably, but inappropriately skeptical, and wonders why. And that's why I like the way the angel responds. Look at verse 18. Zacharias said to the angel, "How shall I know this? I'm an old man, and my wife is well advanced in years." And the angel answered and said, "I am Gabriel, who stand in the presence of God." In other words, I just came from headquarters here. You know, it's God who sent me here. He's standing right outside the office door, and you're arguing with me? So, of course, he tells him he'll have this much of a sign. He'll be mute. He won't be able to speak. But notice, by the way, I skipped over, but let me just do this real quickly. Look at verse 15. One of the things that he says, that Gabriel says concerning this boy to be born is, he'll be great in the sight of the Lord. He'll be filled with the Holy Spirit from his mother's womb. He'll turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. He'll go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children. He's citing Malachi 4. He's saying he is going to be the fulfillment of the disobedience of the wisdom and so on. He's also going to be a lifetime Nazarite. Well, I got to be quick. The thing is, John the Baptist, have any of you been to Israel? So have you been to Qumran? Do you remember going to Qumran and seeing a slideshow? I shouldn't get into it. But there is this fable that John the Baptist was part of the Qumran community, and then that's taken to the wicked notion that John the Baptist learned his whole idea of a coming deliverer from the Qumran community, and he and his cousin Jesus sat down and made up this whole ploy to fool the world with it, and you'll see a lot of it. In fact, John the Baptist seems to have been reared there in the wilderness near the Dead Sea. But about 30 years later, John the Baptist emerged. And, well, let's just look at Matthew 3. Do this, and one point will be done. Matthew 3. Look, John the Baptist, I said earlier, is hugely strategic. We're told in Matthew 10. That John did no miracle. I mentioned that to you before. I think the reason is, primarily, that it was so important that nobody mistake John as the Messiah. They were waiting for a Messiah. And John, again and again, said, "I am not the Messiah." And lest there be any confusion, John never does any miracles. But that just makes it the more amazing that the nation responded as they did. Because if you look at Matthew chapter 3, it says, "In those days, John the Baptist came preaching in the wilderness of Judea, the area down by the Dead Sea, near Jericho, maybe a little north of there, saying, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is about to burst in on you.'" That's the point. "And for this is he who was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah." Matthew says, this is the fulfillment. This is the one, Isaiah 40. "This is the voice of one crying in the wilderness." Then he says in verse 4, "John himself was clothed in camel's hair with a leather belt around his waist. His food was locusts and wild honey." But look at this. "Jerusalem, all Judea, and all the region around the Jordan went out to him." And it's interesting that the word that Matthew uses there when it says "went out to him" is a word that means climbed out to him. In other words, John deliberately put himself in an inhospitable place. It wasn't easy. And when you got there, it wasn't easy to live out there. This is the Jeshimon. I could tell you a lot about it. We'd go there and see it. But this is a very, very unforgiving, inhospitable place. And John went there very deliberately. So it wasn't an easy thing. But yet all Jerusalem and all Judea and all the region came out to him. So much so, I should have left myself time. But in John chapter 1, you have this remarkable interview where the leaders from Jerusalem come out to John and they say, "Who in the world are you? We're supposed to be in charge of things Jewish, in charge of things religious, and the whole world's coming out to you and you haven't checked with us. Who are you?" Remember, John says, "I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness." Remember, they say, are you Elijah? "No, I'm not Elijah." That's another problem. We can talk about that. But then, "Are you the prophet that you come?" "No, I am the voice of one crying." And then he says, "There is one coming after me." Now, John ministers for some time. Thousands and thousands, I believe, of people are coming out to him. I think they savingly believe. Now, let me say this too. You could get saved in the Old Testament, right? There are already a lot of believing people. And when they heard this message, they'd have come out and submitted to John's baptism. So you have this really significant population of people who go back and permeate the land and live in their communities and so on. Now, one day, late in the day, Jesus comes and is baptized. There's a lot we could say about that. When he is baptized, God speaks from heaven, "This is my beloved Son," and so on. Immediately after Jesus' baptism, the Spirit of God falls upon him. That's the theocratic anointing of the Old Testament. It's all over the page of the Old Testament. Drives him into the wilderness. Now Jesus fasts for 40 days. He eats nothing. He is at the very precipice of death. After a 40-day fast, you are just barely alive. There's an interesting contrast, I think, very deliberate, between the temptation of the first Adam in Genesis 3, in which case Adam is surrounded by every conceivable advantage, right? All of his needs are met. And the temptation of the last Adam in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, at which point he is put at every conceivable disadvantage. And yet, in that horribly, horribly disadvantaged state, in every way, he's alone, he's in one of the most barren spots on earth, he's physically at the end of his, near death, and now the devil comes and tempts him, and Jesus simply trusts in the Word of God. I told you this before, but it's one of the most profound insights you can take with you about Jesus. During his life on earth, Jesus had no more spiritual resources than you and I. He was every bit as dependent upon the Word of God as you are, upon the Spirit of God as you are, and he simply entrusted himself to the Word of God and withstood that temptation. I believe that after that, there was a period of recuperation. I know that there are those who believe that Jesus just miraculously spoke himself into health. I reject that. I do not believe Jesus ever used his miracle-working powers on his own behalf, because he came to live your life before you. And you can't do that. And furthermore, the Bible is explicit that the Father sent angels. Why? Because Jesus was alone. He was about to die. He could not care for himself. And I think those angels did for him what you and I would have done had we been there. And that is, got him food and tried to make him comfortable and dressed his sores and nursed him back to health. So now, how much time is it going to take to recuperate from a 40-day fast, would you say? To where you can just perambulate and, well, at least that long, right? At least another month and a half. So Jesus is, that's probably at least a 3-month, maybe a 4-month ordeal where Jesus goes 40 days, that's a month and a week, and then is tempted, and then a period of recuperation. Look at John 1 and verse 29. Jesus' public ministry does not begin with his baptism. I like to say that Jesus' baptism is not the first act of his public ministry, it's the last act of his private life. He goes off to be baptized simply because it's the right thing to do. That's what he tells John the Baptist. But as he comes up out of the waters of baptism, that which he has been waiting for ever since he was a boy of 12 in Luke 2, and that is to be busy about his Father's business, the Spirit of God comes upon him and thrusts him into that ministry. So now Jesus has begun his messianic ministry, but it begins privately there in the Jeshimon in the wilderness as he is tempted of the devil. Now, having recovered from that 40-day fast, John gives us the first 5 or 6 days, depending on how you reckon it, of Jesus' public ministry. John 1:29, the next day, all right, time out real quickly. In John 1:19-28, you have the story of that interview where the Sanhedrin has sent people out to John the Baptist and said, "Who in the world are you?" That make sense to you? Then John 1:29 says, the next day, the day after that interview, the next day, John saw Jesus coming from the wilderness. Well, I better read it to you. The next day John saw Jesus. Does it say coming from the wilderness? What does it say? All of a sudden I lost. Coming to him. The next day John saw Jesus coming toward him and said, "Behold the Lamb of God." This is the first day of Jesus' public ministry. This is the first time John announces Jesus as the Messiah. I don't think he probably just, yawned and said, "Oh, there's the Lamb." I think he was jumping around and tearing his hair and saying, "That's the one, that's the one. You've been waiting. I've been telling you he's coming. Behold, that's the one." It's interesting that in the next several verses, I'm not going to take time to do it, but as John first introduces Jesus, He stomps all over it. Well, I better read. Look at it. He says, verse 30, "This is he of whom I said, after me comes a man who is preferred before me. For he was before me. I didn't know him. I never met him. We didn't cook this up. But that he should be revealed to Israel, therefore I came baptizing. And John bore witness." That means he put himself under oath. He said, "I swear to you, this is the one. I saw the Spirit descending from heaven. He remained upon him. I didn't know him. But he who sent me to baptize with water said to me, 'Upon whom you see the Spirit descending and remaining, on him, this is he who baptized. And I have seen and testified, this is the Son of God.'" Why does John the Baptist stomp all over? Why is he saying, "I'm swearing to you"? Because Jesus was so horribly disappointing as a Messiah. I think he still probably is bearing in his body the marks of a 40-day fast. At any rate, he's just a peasant. And you've been waiting for this glorious Messiah who will deliver you from Rome, and here comes this lone peasant Nazarene wandering out of the wilderness, probably still bearing in his body the marks of a 40-day fast, and John is saying, "I'm swearing to you, this is the one." This is why I told you the other day, I think it's so important that he heard the voice from heaven, because he could say, "I know this is the one. It's hard to believe. I don't blame you for that, but this is the one." This is why it's so amazing when later on in prison, this man, John the Baptist, sends to Jesus and says, "Are you the one that should come?" Because he's so disappointed that Jesus himself, that Jesus doesn't do something about the Roman authorities. All right, real quickly. Look at that's the first day. Look at verse 30. Verse 35. Again, the next day. That's the second day of Jesus' ministry. Look at verse 43. The following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee. That's the third day. And then look at John 2, verse 1. On the third day after verse 43. So the point is, by my reckoning, you have the first 5 days. It is just 5 days into his public ministry. He shows up at that wedding in Galilee in John chapter 2. So Jesus begins his ministry. John continues to minister. Now with this, we're done. I promise you. Go to John chapter 3. There is a facet of John's ministry that to me, honest to goodness, it takes my breath away every time I look at it. I honor John. And let me say, first of all, before I take you, go to John chapter 3. You know what's going to happen, that John is going to functionally retire from ministry, but he is going to hound Herod Antipas about having his... Oh, I could go on and on about this. This was such a scandal. It was such a big thing. And see, the thing is, Herod Antipas had supposedly converted to Judaism. So this is a pretending Jew who has brazenly taken his brother Philip's wife and it was a huge scandal, and it ramifies for the next 40 years, by the way. There's going to be a battle maybe 20 years later the battle's going to be between Herod Antipas and the man, the father of the wife that he abandoned in order to have Herodias. His name was Aretas, the king. But at any rate, it was a huge, huge issue. I mean, it was a political scandal. It was the stuff of all the scandal sheets and so on. And John the Baptist continually hounds Herod until finally Herod arrests him. And then you have that event where Salome dances and Herod Antipas promises her whatever she wants, and she demands, and Herod's gonna kill John the Baptist. He paid deeply. One of the things that's remarkable about John is that he was universally adored. You remember? All right, and I got to tell you that story. Two things. You remember when Jesus was on the Temple Mount? We talked about this last year. And he was taking on all comers. And his enemies, the Sadducees, came and said, "By what authority do you take control of the Temple Mount?" And Jesus responded by saying, "You tell me, the baptism of John, was it of heaven or men?" Remember that? And Jesus had painted them into a corner there so cleverly. But the point is, the Sadducees put their heads together and they said, "Wait a minute, we're asking him if he's really Messiah. If we acknowledge that John's baptism was really of God, then John announced him, so he is the Messiah. We got the answer to our question. We can't say that. But if we say that John the Baptist, his baptism was of men, these people will stone us because they love John the Baptist." Now, John the Baptist was already dead by that time. And that story that I just mentioned to you in passing, that wasn't quite that much later. It must have been about... My chronology was off, so let me back up. It would only have been less than a decade later that Herod Antipas went to battle against this man, Aretas, whose daughter he had sent home. Well, he hadn't sent her home. She had got wind of what was happening. She escaped with her head still on her neck. But you know, it makes sense to you. Herod Antipas had rejected this daughter of King Aretas, and there was a battle between the two, and Herod Antipas was roundly defeated, and Josephus and all the sources we have from that era all say that the reason Herod Antipas lost that battle because God was angry over what he did to John the Baptist. So, I mean, there was just this universal adoration of John the Baptist. It's really staggering. Now, I say that just to make this point. What happens is, go to John chapter 3. John continues to minister. Jesus' ministry has begun. He has gone up and changed water to wine. He has come back and cleansed the temple. He's interviewed Nicodemus. He spent, we can't say exactly how long, but several weeks, maybe a couple of months down here in Judea. But as part of that ministry, look at John 3 and verse 22. This is a part of Jesus' ministry. This is before the Galilean ministry. This is within the first 4 or 5 months of Jesus, of John 1:29. But it says, after these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea, and there he remained with them and baptized after this interview with Nicodemus in John 3. And it says, John also was baptizing in Anan near Salim, because, here's our Baptist verse, there was much water there. Don't we like that verse? And they came and were baptized. So, what we're told is that for a season, do you realize this? Jesus was ministering alongside John the Baptist. There were evidently two evangelistic teams inviting people who would acknowledge the Messiahship of Jesus to come and be baptized. And John was still conducting his ministry, and he had his disciples, and Jesus began to minister somewhere nearby. And look at verse 25. There arose a dispute, and this is a little confusing, but there arose a dispute between some of John's disciples and the Jews, and the Jewish leadership, that's what John means, about purification. Now, what that dispute was, we don't know, because it gets totally lost in the narrative, because the next verse simply says, they, that is, John's disciples, who were confused, came to John, but their real concern was this. They said to him, Rabbi, he who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he's baptizing, and all are coming to him. John's disciples were jealous that Jesus was getting bigger crowds than John was. And John's response to this is one of the most magisterial narratives in all the pages of Scripture. Now, let me say before I read it two things real quickly. Number one, understand that for several months, there simply was nobody more universally famous and adored in all the Jewish world than John the Baptist. He turned the Jewish world on its ear. We have the evidence of the narrative, and then we have the evidence of later remembrances of John, that he had been catapulted into super celebrity notoriety. And I'll tell you something, and I don't want to get personal and I don't want to get specific, but I think celebrity Christianity is one of the most awful aberrations Satan has all ever visited upon us. I do not understand our willingness to assign. And I'm not saying they're wicked. And, of course, you can chalk this up to sour grapes. Help yourself. Bob Bookman wishes he were famous. I really, in my heart of hearts, don't think I do. But I'll tell you this. Its effects are awful. But John the Baptist, for a few heady months was absolutely as great a celebrity as the Jewish world has ever known. I mean, it can't be mistaken, and his impact is so huge. But notice the way he responds. It says in verse 27, John answered when he heard them saying, wait a minute, Jesus is getting bigger crowds than you are. John answered and said, a man can receive nothing unless it's been given to him from heaven. And you yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not Messiah. I'm only the forerunner. I've been sent before him. And then John goes on to say something that just, like I say, takes my breath away. He says, he who has the bride is the bridegroom. But the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Now, to understand what John is saying, you have to understand the marriage customs of the day. Have I talked to you about this? marriages in Jewish culture, and this is the same, it's the same today in Orthodox culture, there were two stages. First of all, there was the betrothal, and then there was the wedding. Now, the betrothal was, there was no great rejoicing or ceremony, but the two families, the family of the bride and the family of the groom, would come together, and marriages were generally arranged. I know, I always tell people that when I say that, people say, oh, how primitive and barbaric that was. Well, you'll forgive me, but if all the demons in hell took a whole weekend to come up with a means of courtship that was most thoroughly doomed to destruction, they'd pretty much come up with what we've got, right? So the idea that we're looking back with any sort of arrogance on it. But honest to goodness, this was a clan. They lived as clans, and one clan had a young man, another clan, they would come together, and they would sign a contract, and they were betrothed. They weren't just, I'm going to talk about this more in another setting, but they weren't just engaged, they were betrothed. And what would happen is that during the period of the betrothal, and it was stated in the contract would say, on such and such a day, there's going to be a wedding, and you would begin to plan for that. But in the meanwhile, in the period of betrothal, it could not be more than a year. It was usually several months, and it was basically up to the father of the groom to determine. But during that period of betrothal, the groom's responsibility was to build a home for the couple, and the bride's responsibility was to make herself beautiful and keep herself pure. Because the wedding was simply this. On the wedding day, the groom would simply go to the home of the bride and fetch her to the home that he had built. Now, I want to talk about this again tomorrow night in connection with Nativity, so I'm not going to go much farther than that. We'll draw it somewhat tomorrow night. But suffice it to say that was the time of rejoicing, and it would be a great parade, and you'd make your way through the town, and you would sing and dance, and the bride would be outfitted in all of her accoutrements that she had prepared, and oftentimes she'd be held up on a chair, and you'd be singing and dancing and throwing rose petals and who knows what all, and it would take some time. That was the wedding parade, and might I say, if you encountered wedding parade, and you didn't even know those people, you stopped what you were doing and you got it on for a few minutes. You sang and danced and carried on because it was absolutely obligatory that you rejoice if you were having anything to do with the wedding. Remember the guy with the drab garment and the wedding feast that got thrown out? You can't be in here with that because you had to rejoice. It was the time. But the problem is that in the course of the wedding march, the attention was very, very much on the bride. And the groom tended to get a little forgotten. And so they had contrived, and this shows up a couple of times in the scriptures, this is the 10 virgins and so on, they had contrived just a little artifice, a little protocol, whereas they approached the home that the groom had made, and by the way, what they were going to do is they were going to come to the home that the groom has prepared, and then there was going to be a wedding feast. And that wedding feast would go on for several days. It was what you and I would think of as almost an open house. When you had a little time, you'd come and you'd make merry, and you'd eat and so on, and this is why Mary, the mother of Jesus, was so horrified when they wanted wine at a wedding feast. Remember that? And by the way, without being at all indelicate, on the first night of the wedding feast, the bride and the groom would repair for the first time to the wedding chamber, and they would look, can I say delicately, for physical proof of her purity, of her virginity, and would rejoice over that and so on. It was so huge that she'd keep herself pure for that husband. And all this becomes so redolent in the New Testament because there's so much marriage terminology in the New Testament. Think about this. Let not your heart be troubled. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it weren't so, I'd have told you so. I'm going to prepare a place for you. If I go to prepare a place for you, I'm going to come and take you to myself so that where I am, there you may, that's wedding talk. That's what's going on there in the upper room. Jesus is saying, I've wed myself to you, and I'm going to come and get you. That's wedding talk. All right, I leave it alone. The point is that, no, I can't leave it alone. Let me tell you one other thing. Because you told me I could go. Because, I'm done. Remember my Philippians 3? I think I told you last time. There are four chapters in Philippians. And the first word in chapter 3 is finally. I'm trying to remember that. See what I'm saying? But the fact is that in the ancient, in this culture we're talking about, they married quite young. Now, they were remarkably more mature than they are today, but they married in the early teens. A boy usually was around 15 or 16, a girl about 13 or 14 when they married, and it was simply because they were clans. They were living as clans, and it was terribly important for your clan to be large, and the only way to grow your clan was to marry the kids and get them more kids. And so as soon as they were of childbearing age, they got married. But even at that, it was a serious thing. Here you've got this young lady, she's 13, 14 years old, and you've got this young man, he's 15 years old, and you're going to entrust that young lady to that young man, and he seems awfully young, but you really weren't entrusting him to the man. You were entrusting him to the clan. And if it was a strong clan, then you could trust it. And that's exactly what Jesus means. Because Jesus there in the upper room has told his disciples things they don't want to hear. They're confused. We don't know what's going on. And Jesus says, let not your heart be troubled. In my Father's house are many mansions. And we say, what's he talking about? What's heaven? All he means is, my Father is the master of a great clan. He has a great problem. You can trust him. So if I'm telling you things that are hard on you, if you're staggering over what I'm telling you, you can trust my Father. You've had 4,000 years to trust my Father. So if you're having trouble with me, trust my Father. That's what he means. Let not your heart be troubled. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it weren't so, I'd have told you. I'm going to prepare a place for you. Now, I return to what I was saying before. As they approach the home and where the wedding feast would commence, the groom would slip away. And it was all very well understood. But he would slip away, and they would come to the home, and they'd start to make merry. And after a while, they'd start, where's the groom? We need the groom. We can't really start without the groom. Where's the groom? And all of this seems to have been, as best we can tell, sort of an artifice to refocus the spotlight a little bit on the groom who got left out in this last enterprise. So there was somebody, and he was called the friend of the bridegroom. And he was normally the fella who had brokered the marriage. So he knew the groom well. He always sent somebody who knew the groom well to the home of the bride to broker the marriage. And he was called the friend of the bridegroom. And there in the wedding feast, as they awaited the coming of the groom, for several minutes, for a little while, all the attention was on the friend of the bridegroom. Because he knew the groom's voice. And he would be waiting to hear the groom's voice. And pretty soon here comes the groom, and he's singing, and the friend of the bride, he's coming, there he is. Now, how infinitely inappropriate would it be for the friend of the bridegroom to resent the fact that when the bridegroom arrived, all the attention was his? See the point? And that's what John means when he says, I love this. He simply says, he that has the bride is the bridegroom. What's that mean? This is all about the bridegroom. It's not about the friend of the bridegroom. He's just got a part to play, and he ought to be mighty glad he's got that part to play. But this is about the bridegroom. And I just think for John, who had such notoriety, and that is so seductive, and when John is told, wait a minute, his own disciples are jealous that she's... John is horrified. And he says, wait a minute, I'm only the friend of the bridegroom. He that has the bride is the bridegroom. And then he goes on and says, he must increase, and so I must decrease. And for everything we can tell, John stepped out of ministry. He was so horrified at the thought that somebody would be jealous that Jesus was getting more attention that he just stepped out of ministry. It's one of the most noble scenes in all the scriptures. And if you ever get around men who are afforded notoriety status, and you begin to watch how quickly it gets a hold of them, goes to their head, and oh, folks, without any negative examples, is it not important that we acknowledge what a blessedness it is just to be a friend of the bridegroom? But that's all we are. This is not about us. This is about the bridegroom. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. This whole affair is about the bridegroom. I just think that's why I say John the Baptist is one of my greatest heroes, and in so many ways he's a man so much to be admired. But in that moment when he is horrified at the thought that the attention given him will take away in any way from the attention that Jesus deserves, the way he responds is one of the most noble scenes in all the scripture in my mind. Okay, well, I'll finish with this. The John the Baptist, I'm going to finish where I started. John the Baptist's ministry laid the foundation in ways that I think is very little appreciated for the ministry of Jesus. He truly was the forerunner. He's one of the great, great heroes of the Bible and a man much to be emulated. All right, well, thank you for the time. It's ridiculously late.